the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Adam Martin is a senior manager of software engineering at Salesforce.org. A first-generation college student, Adam was first exposed to IT in high school through a program that paired students with local tech businesses. Ultimately earning his MBA at GU, Adam serves nonprofit clients up and down the U.S. West Coast.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. How you doing?
Yeah, it's a little different not being on the pickleball court or seeing you on your Vespa, but that's where the magic happens. So that's your at home office.
This is it, man. In the basement, in the cave. I used to be in a real office, and then my wife started working from home, so I got kicked out.
Yeah, no, I know how that works. I kind of like with I wanted a dog. My wife wanted a cat, so we compromised and got a cat kind of deal. Yeah. So my negotiation skills, if will. So the only good part about that is the cat likes me better, I guess, in the end. So
there you go.
But good, man. Well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to do this. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And this all started, I think, when we were thinking about all the cool things Zags were doing in a variety of ways and a variety of capacities. And so today we're going to talk about you, man, you and your journey.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I always say I'm the youngest in my family. So that's my favorite subject is talking about me. Now, if you're not the youngest, it might be awkward for you, but we're going to get you there. So
I am the oldest. I'm the oldest of two, actually. Yeah. But it can be a little bit awkward sometimes. We can dive straight in. I'm good for it.
Yeah, well, you got a good looking haircut. You're rocking and rolling. We'll get this party started. So you're a Spokane guy, right? You grew up here.
I am. Yeah, I grew up here. LC grad, went to Lewis and Clark High School. For that, I grew up in what is now the Perry District. It was not the Perry District when I grew up there. It was a lot different.
A very different place. Yeah.
Very different place when I grew up there. But yeah, so I grew up in Spokane. I moved away for a few years to where I lived in Chicago for a while, but then came back to Spokane in, I think, 2017. Sounds right. So I've been back in Spokane now for about 7 years.
Did you go to Grant Elementary?
I did.
I remember being even like in high school, I wouldn't, and you would have been closer to junior high back then, but you didn't feel super safe on Perry. I mean, like there was like a Heiko Market there with bars on it.
Not at all. Yeah. When I grew up there, there wasn't even a Heiko Market. It was something called XL Foods. So the Heiko is even a little bit fancier, what is now a great restaurant, the French restaurant there. What is that? My daughter calls it the French Chicken. I can't remember what it's called, but that used to be a pharmacy that we would go to. There was a secondhand clothing store nearby, but it was not the safest neighborhood. It was a place where you would kind of buzz through, not a lot of families out, not a place people would walk around. But it was a great place to be from. And I don't live too much further away from there now. So my family and I, we live up by Manitou Park, and my kids go to Roosevelt, who we used to play, you know, sports with when I went to Grant.
Yeah, no, and it's a very different place now, the Perry District, right? I mean, it's a testament to investment, and I think they poured some money in there, and it's pretty awesome, pretty hip.
Yeah, a lot of work with the community on that one, and I think there were some leaders that were actually from Grant. There was a guy named Jerry Numbers, who was the gym teacher at Grant Elementary School, who was a big part of kind of working with the community and doing some of that investment there in the neighborhood. To create the Perry District. So it's pretty cool.
Well, I'm hoping your parents held onto their house and got to ride the
a little bit. Yeah. My mom sold the house just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So LC Tiger. And then your next step was not Gonzaga, right? You went to Eastern.
Yeah. So actually my next step, my path to Gonzaga is definitely not typical, I'm guessing. And so my next step after high school was to the community college. So I went to the Falls for a few years. I say that it took me about 5 years to get an associate's degree because when I was in high school, I was a part of a few different business programs, information technology programs that were related to Running Start. They tried an experiment called the Information Technologies Academy, where I got the opportunity to work with small businesses in Spokane. I also got my foot in the door in technology. We learned things like basic web design, how to work on websites, start to get into things like Photoshop early on in the early 2000s, and got to do an internship with a small company here called Class 101. And I met a guy there named Phil Autry, who was the owner of that company and a local entrepreneur. And we got to get paid as a high school student to work at a small startup tech company. And unfortunately, that program, it was with in association with the community colleges, fizzled out after a few years, couldn't continue, but gave me a really great foundation of starting to work in technology sector. I didn't know really what I wanted to do, though. So when I graduated, I then went on to the Falls. I was kind of figuring out what my life was going to look like. And so I spent a few years there working at a lot of local restaurants and then eventually made my way to Eastern. Yes.
Yeah. And I just pulled this up on Google. Like, was it Safe Desk Solutions? Is that where you were at?
Yeah. Safe Desk Solutions was one of the brands that we had worked on. There was a few different companies. The larger shell company or larger company was called Class 101, but Safe Desk was this interesting idea, sort of a pre-cloud computing company. We worked in Linux, getting very nerdy. So we can get into why I'm so nerdy now.
Let's do it in
my job. But basically, we would work with these school districts across the country. Microsoft had a program a long time ago where they would give away computers through their partnership with Gateway to school districts and use Microsoft and the Microsoft suite within K-12 education. And so there were a lot of aging computer labs across the country. And if you remember, computer labs were a thing back then. It wasn't everyone had their own laptop. Everyone didn't have their own tablet. You'd go to a computer lab of 20 or 30 computers for the school.
Yeah, I remember internet cafes, like going to the internet cafe and paying for internet, check your email. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So the idea for Safe Desk is that we would go and we would sell them a big server that these computers would then attach to then be able to do higher end processing and computing. So they could basically take a computer lab that was aging and failing and use just a very small amount of the local processing power of their computer, but do the bulk of the work on this server. So you could take a group of 20 computers that really weren't as functional as they could be and run Linux on them and basically create workable workstations for students. They could then dial into these things using dial-up internet from home, perhaps. But this was a really interesting and cool way of doing what we call thin computing in sort of a pre-cloud environment.
Trying to remember what, and it almost sounds like it's like a model of a cloud. The servers are further away, I guess, now or on some level. Exactly. I remember what Linux is. Was that like, why am I drawing a blank? I'm thinking of like my first email account, right? But that was called Pine.
Linux is still alive and well today. It's an operating system that computers can run off of. It's an open source operating system, so it's something that anyone can create different variations of, and developers get into there. So, you know, your computer, your phone, different servers you run off of likely have Linux running somewhere within them to make the thing work that you're using. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I should know more about that. But it's ringing a bell now. I want to say for a time it was like I'm anti Microsoft, I'm anti Apple, so I'm using Linux.
Yeah, you're pretty cool if you're
totally running. Totally. Okay, so go to Eastern and you study business at Eastern?
I went to Eastern. At first, I started studying business, and I found that, in my opinion, the business program at the time was, so I commuted back and forth. I was living in downtown. I was working at in restaurants as a bartender, and I was commuting back and forth to Eastern. And I found that for me, the program there at the time, the undergraduate program is especially, I had very, very large classes that I was in. There were students of, you know, classes of maybe over 100 students at a time. I didn't find that the material to be especially stimulating to me. It wasn't something that I wanted to pursue. Again, I'd come off of doing my AA degree, started in the business program there. And so eventually I made the switch and got my degree in economics. So okay. I swapped over just a light pivot to economics. Wanted to dive in a little bit deeper into some of the theory, some of the math, started getting into macroeconomics, a little bit of behavioral economics was always very, very interesting to me. And so I shifted that way. And then I also ended up doing a little bit of poli-sci in government while I was there. So I got my minor in government and poli-sci. Yes.
Interesting. I'm surprised to hear that big of classes. I wonder if it's probably changed now.
I'm guessing it's probably changed. You know, this was at the time, it was probably 2007, 2008. There were some large auditorium classes there in what was Kingston Hall. I think it's still Kingston Hall. But yeah, I found that I wasn't really a part of the campus. I wasn't really diving into getting into small discussions with the classes I wanted to. And so I decided that, you know, maybe I could get into a program that was a little bit more stimulating for me. And I found the economics classes that I was taking at the time were really, really interesting. And actually, I mean, this is kind of the lead up to my path to going to GU. This was a time when I met you.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Through one of your cousins, one of your many, many cousins. I think you were probably recently graduated or getting ready to graduate yourself from Gonzaga. And it was interesting because I'll say my path to Gonzaga, you were a part of that. Like you wow. were a big one. You know, I grew up, as I mentioned, I grew up kind of in what is now the Perry District. But my mom was a single mom. She was a young single mom in the 80s. And when I was very little, she actually worked at Gonzaga.
Oh, wow.
And she worked at Gonzaga in the dining hall and in catering. And she has a story that I haven't quite verified yet. But she swears that she worked in the dining hall with Thane McCullough.
Wow.
I know. She told me this in a moment when she was very proud of me when I was graduating from Gonzaga. But she was like, you know, I worked with Thane when I worked again. I was like, that okay, we'll find out one day. Well,
yeah. Well, I'm gonna say that's very, very likely because I feel like Thane's almost had every role at Gonzaga over his long tenure.
Yeah.
So that's incredible. And that's Spokane for you, right? The small. So now if she would have stuck around, you could have gone for free. That was the
I know. That would have been nice. Yeah. So she was working there. And so Gonzaga had always been a really a place that I had aspired to go to when I was younger. But I didn't really ever think that it was a real option for me. You know, I went to high school. I did okay, but, you know, really didn't ever put in the real work needed to get great grades. But I'd always had a lot of potential. Then took my time in community college and then at Eastern. And actually, in a conversation with you, I said, you know, I would love to be able to go to Gonzaga one day. I just don't think it's real. And you were like, let's talk about this. Like there's no reason why this couldn't happen. Let's figure this out. And you were very, very adamant and serious. And so you're one of the very first people that actually gave me the confidence to say like, maybe that's a real thing I could do. Maybe there's a path where that could work out. And eventually it happened. So it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome to hear. I'll be honest with you. I totally don't remember that conversation.
You know, it was at Jack and Dan's. It was a long time ago. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, I'm certainly glad that you're a Zag now. So yeah. Eastern graduate. Did you work for a while after graduating?
Yeah, that's right. So I went to Eastern and graduated from Eastern in 2010. And at the time, I was still working in restaurants, and I had met I had a girlfriend at the time who is now my wife. Graduated from Eastern and decided to take the opportunity to travel. And so I had saved up a little bit of money while I was working, graduated from Eastern, took a couple of months and went to Southeast Asia, went backpacking throughout Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And then came back and said, all right, now I've done this. I've graduated. I've celebrated. What do I want to do? I got to go and figure this thing out. So I went back to the restaurant and I applied at a couple of places. I went to first, there was a great job that I looked at Vanessa Behan. They were looking for someone who could do outreach, community outreach and development and donations. And I was wildly unqualified for that role, but I thought, hey, I've got a lot of confidence. I'll go ahead and apply for that. I had a plan B to teach English in South Korea. That was a, plan B. And then a friend of mine said, hey, I'm working at this small company and we just got acquired by another company and we're hiring salespeople. And I said, I really don't want to be in sales. Cause when I was previously working at Safe Desk Solutions and Class 101, I was in sales. I was heavily in sales. I would call people all day and I would say, you know, I really don't want to do that anymore. I went back to school so that I wouldn't have to do this frontline sales stuff. But you know what, I'll go and I'll apply and I'll take the role. And so this company was called Jigsaw. It was based out of Post Falls and I went and applied and they offered me a position. And so I started there and they had just been acquired by Salesforce. So that was in 2010. And so I was offered a job at Salesforce in a role that's called a sales rep, we call it. And basically I was an inside sales rep. So if anyone would, you know, look at a website at a time, fill out a form, go to a trade show, look at somebody the wrong way, they'd fall into a queue and a kid like me would give them a call. I'd make 60 or 70 phone calls a day. And it was probably the best job I've ever had.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. My whole job was to just call oftentimes small business owners and talk to them about their business. All I would do is just ask them like, hey, how does your business work? And sit down and have open, intimate conversations with them about how do they make money? What challenges do they currently have? Is there something that technology can solve? And then my job was to pass that on, take that information down and pass it on to someone else, one of our account executives within the business. I would qualify leads was my entire job.
So you're getting, I mean, you're getting probably the whole gamut of characters on these phone calls, right?
You get everyone, right? Sometimes you get to talk to a VP of a Fortune 500 company. Sometimes you're talking to a guy with an idea in a shed. You're talking to people who are running very, very passionate people who are running nonprofits. You're talking to schools. You're talking to students. You're talking to everyone and anyone because the time Salesforce was actually not a very large company in 2010. It wasn't a well-known name. I didn't know what the company was when I had started. I knew they sold CRM, but they'd only been around at that time for about 10 years. The company started in 1999 and had just started doing some of these acquisitions. And so for me, it was a great chance to be actually curious, have conversations that I was trained for in school and through bartending to learn how to just be upfront, ask conversations, not be afraid to talk to somebody. And just hit the phones. And I did very, very well in that role and was promoted pretty quickly. And it was funny because my hiring manager, I had received an award a couple of months later, the Rising Star Award. And the manager said, hey, this really worked out because, man, I was told to just hire the next person that came in the door. I said, wow. Thanks, man. That's
really good. Yeah. Like we need bodies. Yeah. There he is right there. He's got a heartbeat. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. And so luckily I did well and I was in, eventually moved into one of those account executive roles where I carried a patch of business. I had a regional territory. And my thing was to just stay really, really curious, not to rush people through and try and have conversations to learn about businesses. And to just stay really diligent about getting on the phone with them and always saying, not being afraid to take on some new ideas. There was a point in time at the company where my territory was a very small couple of zip codes in New York, in New York City, and what we called the rest of the world, which was everything outside of the United States for a very small product. And so when I was doing that, I took on some odd hours. I would work from 11 p.m. to about 5 a.m. Because I was working with colleagues that were in Ireland and Australia at different times on multiple days of the week. It worked really well because my wife was working at the YWCA in their domestic violence shelter overnight. And so she would be there working nights. And so I would work nights from home in my office here, and stayed really open to just having lots and lots of conversations with business owners at this point throughout the country and then the entire world. And that gave me the opportunity to start traveling a little bit. Got the chance to go to Ireland and to Dublin and to London to work and meet with customers, which was pretty exciting. And I did really, really well in my role early on as a sales rep, which was fun. Yes.
Wow. And so at that time, you're selling the Salesforce CRM, basically. Is that correct?
Yeah, selling Salesforce CRM and data that was used within the CRM. We were selling basically, it was a product line through an acquisition that was called data.com. A really great URL, especially today. Yeah. You go there, Salesforce still has it. It's now for a new product, but selling something we call data.com and selling leads. And what had happened was did very well, but the company kind of shifted and changed focus. And so while I was a top performing sales rep, had the opportunity to go to some of the incentive clubs, et cetera, my team was laid off. They said, you know what, we're going to shift. And while you're a great rep and you've done very well in your role, we hope that you can find another role within the company. If not, here's a very nice severance package for you. And so they gave me a very, very nice lead time and potential severance package, but also the opportunity to go and find other roles. And so my wife and I, we decided, you know, what do we want to do with our lives? I had just had our first daughter. She was about one. And I had always had a passion and curiosity for technology, even more so than selling. And so there was a role within the company that I'd always been interested in called a solution engineer. And a solution engineer is someone who works in our pre-sales consulting process, someone who gets to go in and have very, very curious conversations with anybody about their company, learn about the systems and technologies that they use, and learn their language and vernacular of whatever industry it is, and then translate that to some of our Salesforce technologies, sort of right fit some of the things that we would do, and even get hands-on and build proofs of concepts and demos for those customers as they are evaluating our software. And so that's something I had always wanted to do, but it always seemed a little out of grasp. It wasn't something that sales reps would do. They wouldn't typically go from selling to the pre-sales consulting. They would go the opposite direction. You'd oftentimes go from a more technical role into a selling role. And so took this opportunity to then move up market into some of our larger companies at Salesforce, the larger customer base, and moved to Chicago with my family. And so we took a one-year-old and, unbeknownst to the rest of the family at the time, a pregnant wife to Chicago, take on this solution engineering role and start a life in Chicago, living right downtown in the north side of Chicago, close to Wrigley, in a neighborhood called Uptown. Very, very cool place. And I start working there and building a network in technology there.
Yeah. Wow. So are you a Cubs fan now?
Big Cubs fan because we were there. We lived just a few blocks away from Wrigley when they won the World Series.
That's awesome.
Unreal. It was an unreal experience. We got to walk to Wrigley with our kids. We watched every pitch. of those, that World Series. And
oh wow, so you got game tickets and stuff. Wow.
We didn't get to go to the games for World Series. That was a little out of our reach.
Sure,
yeah. Many games that season. It's nice to go to the games in the season, but not during the actual series. You watch those from home.
Yeah, or even being, I mean, near there, I suppose, when I don't know if they close it out in Chicago or not, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They close it out. There's multiple block radius from around Wrigley Field. It's a really fun place to be. Yeah.
That's cool.
So, I mean, this is all leading up to the path to Gonzaga, which for me as a non-traditional student takes a little bit longer, you know, high school. But so we were in Chicago doing great. And then I had met somebody within Salesforce because when I moved to Chicago, I was working in the manufacturing sector on the technology side. But I'd always had this thing in my periphery that was called Salesforce.org, which is the foundation at Salesforce. It was the nonprofit wing. And Salesforce had structured relationships with nonprofits a lot differently. We had a separate foundation, a separate company entirely. They would actually resell Salesforce technology to NGOs, nonprofits, and higher education as sort of endowed industries, either giving away significant parts of the technology. And so today, nonprofits and institutions of higher ed can go in and actually get free licenses from Salesforce today. But we would also work with them to start selling in that process to them. And we would do so at a heavy discount. And then we would take all of that revenue and reinvest it back into higher education and nonprofits. So it was a very, very interesting model. And so I had met someone, a guy named Shay Lewis, who was running the higher education market at the time, and got into conversation with him. And he said, you know, we really need a solution engineer. We're expanding and growing in the West Coast. And so if you're interested in moving to the West Coast, you could join my team. And I said, hey, this could be the time. You know, we had just still owned our home in Spokane, but we're getting ready to sell it and put down roots in Chicago because we love Chicago. And so sort of came to a decision point to move back to Spokane. That was in 2017. And it was a really hard decision. You know, coming back to Spokane can be a very difficult decision for many. Looking back on it, it's the best decision I ever made. So many of my friends have also done so. But when you are out there, if you go back to that time, you think about coming back to Spokane, it's an interesting decision point. And so we decided to move back, kept this house, luckily, that I bought in 2012, luckily, moved back into this home and joined the higher education and nonprofit sector for Salesforce.org. And at that time started working with universities across the West Coast, which is what I still do. I now manage a team of solution engineers here. But when we moved back, one of my biggest concerns was, how do I get integrated back into the Spokane community? You know, what do I want to do? And how can I make sure that I get connected and keep building a network of people within the industries I want to work with? And so I reached out to a friend of mine and yours, KP, Kristen Paul.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would probably make a great guest on this podcast.
That's a great call, yeah.
But at the time, she was working in recruiting for the business school at Gonzaga.
Right, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so in 2017, I talked to her about coming back and getting my MBA. And then I enrolled in the program at that time. So came back to Spokane from Chicago, decided if I was going to move back to Spokane, it was one of my negotiation points that I wanted to go back to school. I wanted to get my MBA at Gonzaga. And I also wanted to learn to ski, which I did.
Awesome.
I didn't grow up skiing, but went up to Mount Spokane and learned how to ski. So that's my path to Gonzaga and a little bit of my early career.
That's cool. Now you get, are you still skiing? You like skiing?
Love skiing. Love skiing. Yeah.
It's not the cheapest hobby to have, but I'm a skier too. And I get it. There's short days in the winter, so it's good to get out and get some fresh air. And,
you know, they say it's a scary one to pick up late in life, but I think anybody could do it. Like, we went to Mount Spokane in their I took lessons, their multi-week, 6-week lesson thing. They make it very, very easy and accessible to rent skis and boots, get you out there with an instructor. They push you and teach you. And now I'm off on my own and I've got this sickness that I've got to go and chase skiing all the time whenever I can. But I will say, coming back to Spokane, it wasn't like a non-negotiable. Like I needed a winter activity. You know, coming back to the city without a winter activity can be very, very tough. So you can go skiing. There's a great curling club here. You can learn to play hockey. There's all sorts of things you can do here. You just got to go and find it.
I didn't realize there was a curling club. I'll just go watch.
That'll be our next hobby, Rue. Don't worry. I'll get you out there.
Wow. Yeah. For folks out there, we're pickleball players. We usually play a weekly game. Adam by far is the best of the group, but he's patient with the rest of us. Yeah,
so far.
Yes. So that's pretty awesome. And I know it took us a while, a bit of a roundabout way, but I believe Gonzaga is using some Salesforce, or at least
that's right,
onboarding at some or something at some point. And then because let's be honest, I'll say it, it's the superior product out there. Right?
Love to hear it. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting. So, yeah, I joined the MBA program in 2017. At the time, I was selling Salesforce, and there was an RFP sent out by Gonzaga for a student success and advising platform, you know, being able to provide a top-notch student service is something in the back end that maybe not a lot of students realize, but is a huge priority for Gonzaga. You know, we talked about caring for the entire person. Technology can actually play a big part of that. And Gonzaga was investing heavily in some back end systems, updating some of the things that they were doing, some of the processes. And so we, Salesforce, and I personally did a big pitch. It was fun because I was in the business school and got to go to one of the classrooms in which I was going and taking classes to do a pitch to the Gonzaga faculty and administration on the way they should use my product, which was a bit multi-layered for me at the time.
Sure.
Even funnier is that we actually lost that pitch. We didn't, you know, Gonzaga chose to go a different direction. After a couple of years, they came back and decided to engage with us and use our platform. And so there's actually a very, very large project going on with one of our great partners at Salesforce, a company called Cloud for Good, that works exclusively within education and with nonprofits to completely refresh the student success platform at Gonzaga, a very, very large project being worked on right now.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'm obviously not involved with that side of the house, but my understanding is we've had some stumbles, but it sounds like we're at the right place now. We've come full circle. We got the right tools in place.
You know, with many, many projects of all sorts, especially technology, but any sort of project, you're going to run into unexpected challenges and kind of work through them. And so this is something that isn't atypical. It's something that every school is going to learn from, make changes to their plans as they evolve and change what they're looking to do. So it's beautiful. Yeah,
for sure. So tell me a little bit about what a solutions engineer does.
Yeah. So what a solution engineer, my job, and now I manage the solution engineering team, which is great. My team works basically west of the Mississippi and throughout Canada with the larger universities and higher ed institutions. So universities like Gonzaga or University of Washington or Washington State, you know, larger organizations, Arizona State, anybody who's in the nonprofit higher education space, we get to work with. Our job is to work with the customers, whoever it could be. It could be different stakeholders. Sometimes these are people in IT. Sometimes these are people on what we would call the business side, or perhaps you as a leader and a director in the accounting program at Gonzaga. I met multiple times with Dean Anderson at the time. We met with Sasha Kopp, the provost at the time. We got to meet with lots of different individuals around what are the technology problems that they have and the process problems maybe that they see and what their goals are around, in this case at Gonzaga, it was around student success. Are they looking to hit specific goals around retention? Are they trying to match challenges around student wellness? What measurements do they have? And learn from a solution engineering side, what sort of systems make up their tool set to accomplish those goals. We then take that and use our Salesforce technology stack, which is significant. It can be things like a backend CRM. It could be things like a marketing and communications platform. Could be an internal communications platform like Slack, maybe data visualization like Tableau. Could be backend data plumbing, like integrations through a product we have called MuleSoft. So we have a very, very large portfolio of products at Salesforce. And we then act as the interpreter. We'll go and we'll say, okay, this is the challenge that these people or this institution has, and this is the language they use in order to talk about the challenges that they have. Now let's take those things and translate them to the technology that we have, and let's bring in specialists and inform them and learn about what we can do to solve those problems. And then we are sort of the conduit in between those two things. We'll actually build proofs of concept. We'll go in and say, you know, you may have a challenge with the way that your students want to schedule appointments or an app that they use perhaps in order to access the services that you have on campus. Well, who are the touch points and endpoints they might have? They have advisors, they could call people, they could email, they might want to use a chat bot. Okay, what's going to fuel all of those different things and how do those transactions actually work together? Our team will go and take our technology, implement it in a way in a demo environment, and bring that back to a university and say, is this the problem and challenge that you're having? And we'll work on that in an iterative process until we can then work with a partner and a school will say, that's it, you've got it, you've nailed it. That's what we want, bring it to us. We will then work with a partner to go and implement that with your existing technology stack. And so my solution engineering team works behind the scenes to do a lot of that interpretation of the challenges that you have, applying our technology to it, and then communicating it back to you in a way that is compelling, that drives value, and that hits the points that your institution has. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that makes some sense. How complex and knowing what the tool can do and how it can be.
Yeah, it's interesting. My team is made up of a lot of different disciplines, I will say. Like, you know, As I mentioned, I have a degree in economics. I didn't get my degree in information technology. I have an individual on my team who has a PhD in journalism. I have somebody on my team who worked in university IT throughout their entire career. I have individuals who was previously a VP of enrollment at a university.
Oh, wow.
And so we get people who come from all walks of life that have a strong understanding of technology and the inner workings and mechanics of a university, both from a people side and from a process side, that can sort of consult and be a part of this process.
Interesting. And your team's all over the West Coast, I would imagine.
All over, yeah. So I have an individual few in California. You know, California is a large place. So we have a couple individuals there. I have somebody in Colorado, somebody in outside of Portland, somebody in Indiana, and another person in Toronto. But our team, so I'm just one of the leaders on our team. Our team is about 40 people. We have a large East Coast team, Midwest team, and then we have specialists dispersed throughout everywhere as well.
Interesting. So yeah. Is Salesforce San Francisco? Is that the headquarters?
San Francisco based. Yeah. About if you have the opportunity to go down to San Francisco, we just built a really big, beautiful tower right in the middle of the city. You'll be able to see it. Give me a call. There are also multiple Zags that are at Salesforce. We might be able to help you get up to the top floor on the right day and time. If you give us enough lead time, we can walk you around what we call the Ohana floor, which is a beautiful community space. 360-degree view of the city and the bay. You catch it on the right day. You could see forever.
Oh, I bet, man. I bet. I did get to go to the London, and it might be called the Tower there too.
Yeah, the London Tower. Yeah.
The London Salesforce Tower. And I think we did go to the Ohana room. We were up top and it was like there's like cafes there, kind of like you get your coffee, but awesome views of everything.
Yeah.
And I think
the London office is beautiful. We also have one in Chicago, Indianapolis, beautiful New York office. And then a few other international offices, Sydney, Japan, Tokyo.
Wow. Are you getting to travel a lot? Do you get to go to?
I used to travel a lot more than I do now, which is nice. So working in higher education, pre-2020, I will say universities were not big on remote communication. Universities, you got to be in person, man. You want to do the work, you got to be on campus. And so I loved it. I had the opportunity to travel probably two or three times a month. I would get to go to college campuses, all sorts of college campuses, which is the coolest thing. Urban campuses, rural campuses, big, small. Everyone is so proud of the campuses they work on. A lot of history and beautiful places that I got to go and attend. It was awesome. And then, you know, there was a big shift. Universities were able to transition during the pandemic faster than any other industry. I'll say, like, getting to work with universities firsthand in doing things like developing contact tracing centers. You know, oftentimes universities are the center of a community. They have a charter to serve their greater community. And so we worked with some universities to create contact tracing centers to keep track of students closely, provide housing, provide resources, stand up websites, make sure students and their wellness were okay, which was a challenge for everyone. But students or universities pivoted very, very quickly to be able to start meeting in remote places, collaborate, keep students in touch with the campuses, and provide services that they would need. It was huge.
Yeah, it was crazy. I'm glad to hear that. And we definitely had, I think our admin did a great job on coordinating a lot of rules and how this is going to work and communicating that. And I remember we had a tracing, I think it was like February of 20, and I'm walking by John Correa's office. He's an MIS prof. And he's like, hey, come check this out. And he was doing a Zoom class just as a test. And he's like, yes, it's like this new technology. And I was like, why do I need that? I got FaceTime, man. And then a month later, you know, I'm on Zoom. And, you know, on our end, at least in the classroom side, obviously there's a lot of aspects to running a campus, but it was how do I put this in a good way, that it was hard to monitor academic dishonesty. We didn't know what we were doing, right? Yeah. And we didn't know the tools and what was going on, which I think unfortunately has hurt some of the students that came through, you know, probably at the high school level as well, but during COVID. I always joke, you know, that you might have a class average in exam one of, you know, 72, exam two, 73, and all of a sudden it's like 94. And it's like, oh man, people are studying real hard now that COVID hit, you know, it's really, really focused, right? You know, so.
You know, it's interesting. It's hard to pinpoint what the symptoms of something like that be. What I'll say though is that I do believe that higher ed is adapting technology and adapting to technology incredibly quickly. So the pandemic, talking about meeting in remote spaces and such, like universities in less than a year and less than 18 months pivoted very, very, they had to, right? Pivoting. So maybe there's a huge amount of pain that you're feeling in that time, you know, that academic dishonesty thing. It's something that you notice in the moment, but universities pivoted and changed really, really quickly in order to change the way that we're going to develop those same course materials. How are we going to learn and assess the proficiencies somebody might have? And it's also shifted more recently as we start talking about things like generative AI, right? Like that became a big challenge for a lot of universities as ChatGPT came to play, right? Everyone said, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
Right.
Students cheat within months. Oh, wait a minute. This exact same tool that we were worried about students using and adapting even faster than the administration, right? Students are at the real cutting edge of technology and say, look, I can have this thing write a paper for me. Oh, look, really quickly, teachers saying, wait a minute, I can use this to more effectively grade papers. I can use this to more effectively administrate classes, perhaps, and cut down on my overhead. And so we're seeing that one right now. We're working really, really closely on with generative AI and technology. And so, yes, you feel the immediate pain, right? You feel like, oh no, this is very, very uncomfortable. But I will say, Gonzaga is an institution, many other institutions, higher ed, learn to pivot very, very quickly and do so in a way that is always in the best interests of students. You know, there's always that concern of like, how do we make sure we are delivering an incredible education and experience to students, better serving them and making sure that they're healthy and well, and also make sure they're learning incredibly well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we certainly have the culture that supports that. You know, one thing we're struggling with as we move forward is the friction between the value of in-person classes and that personal connection versus how much remote options are you offering? Where does that, and we'll work that out in time. I think,
That's going to be a challenge. We're seeing that across the entire sector in education. I know for me, when I was choosing to go to Gonzaga, a in-person experience was the reason why I chose Gonzaga for me in the business school. You know, I could have gone to any, there were many executive MBA programs. There were many online MBA programs from bigger brands and names. I could have probably gone to, you know, a top branded business school remotely, but that wasn't the type of experience that I was looking for. I wanted to be able to be in person. That was a challenge. And so, as I mentioned, I started my MBA in 2017. I didn't finish my MBA until 2022. So I just finished my MBA a couple of years ago.
Yeah, right?
So I took 4.5 years to get my MBA.
That's great.
Did it very, very slowly, one or two classes at a time. I really savored each experience. And I took as many in-person classes as I could. I took as many courses that allowed me to be in small groups with a professor and a small group of students that I could connect with and work on projects intently with, like with a lot of intention. And for me, that was how I could suck as much out of this program as I could. For me, getting the MBA, and I'm excited for the degree and the moniker, but for me, it was the experience that I was there for. I wasn't there to finish the program.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Favorite professor, or a couple professors you had a great experience with, if something comes to mind.
You know, so as I mentioned, I was in economics, and so I really enjoyed Bachiri's class.
Okay.
I love stats. I thought she told great stories. I enjoyed being in class with Bachiri. I enjoy, who else?
Fun story about her. She was offered, I don't know if it was like undersecretary or vice minister of education in Albania, like the number two person there. And she's like, I'll stay at Gonzaga. I'm like, all right.
You know, I find that the professors at Gonzaga are so interesting. They have such incredible backstories and walks of life. They come from everywhere. And so I think it's pretty cool. You know, a professor that I really loved, even though I'm not in accounting, I took Weber's class, Gary Weber's class.
Yeah.
Always like unforgettable. Enjoy, really, really loved being there with Gary Weber. He was an incredible instructor as well and has incredible network, brought in great speakers and was able to help us learn about local industries and other companies and the way that they work. I thought that was very, very interesting too.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right now, you mentioned
a class from you, though.
You're probably that you got lucky. You got because maybe you wouldn't be so high on Gonzaga, or maybe I'd be down a pickleball partner. Maybe who knows?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now you mentioned earlier some other Zags at Salesforce. Now there was a time we had a Zag that was CEO of .org.
That's right. Yeah. So I failed to mention that. So that idea and that experiment of separating out the nonprofit sector into a separate company at Salesforce was in big part to an individual there named Rob Acker, a guy who got his undergrad at Gonzaga. Yeah. And is still an incredible individual who is working for another company now called Hubble. But Rob sort of had that brainchild of an idea to take and build a market out of higher education. You know, for us, it was a philanthropic endeavor at first, where it was, you know what, these schools want to be able to use Salesforce, these nonprofits want to use Salesforce, cool, we'll give them some. We'll just give them some profits. But the challenge there, especially for a company like us, where we're a SaaS company, which at the time was a little revolutionary, a subscription software as a service company, meant that if we weren't invested, if we weren't selling our technology, it could be really, really hard to use. You know, top flight enterprise technology isn't a simple thing. And so giving a nonprofit a lot of complicated technology can actually be a burden for the wrong nonprofit. You know, it's like handing somebody a box full of airplane parts. Like, an airplane is cool and it has a lot of value, but if you don't know how to put it together, you don't know how it works, you can't make it work for you. It could actually be a burden if you spend a lot of time trying to get that to work. And so by creating a separate company that was a reseller of Salesforce, incentivizing salespeople and product people and engineers to build things specifically for this industry, and then taking that money and reinvesting it back into that industry, it's able to build a $300 million a year company. And that was constantly just innovating and bringing value back to those same industries, which was very, very cool. So it was set up as a California company for public good, which is a designation, and basically allowed us to build a community of thousands of customers, lots of advocates, an ecosystem of partners who are helping schools utilize our technology to better serve their customers and realize their missions, as well as nonprofits globally. Some of the largest nonprofits are using Salesforce for their fundraising efforts, for their program management, scout grant management, outcome management, case management, all sorts of different things, and communications, because we were able to build an industry fueled by the success of that industry.
That's awesome. What do you think the, and this is kind of on the prediction side, but what's the next big thing? And that's probably too broad of a question, but, you know, obviously, you know, I think it was at time business analytics or analytics, I guess. You know,
analytics, yeah, was, yeah.
Then and now it's you know, AI and where that's going to lead. What I don't know, from your purview, we're reading the tea leaves. What do you think?
You know, right now we are in an interesting place with generative AI. Salesforce has been talking about AI for a long time and using machine learning and predictive analytics in order to make predictions based on information from the past. Generative AI is the next evolution and step in that. The big part of that being that you're using this massive wealth of information in order to make some of those predictions. And as we've all learned quickly, that technology is moving very, very fast. We've all got it in our hands now on our phones. We can chat with it, but ChatGPT being a killer app for generative AI as a technology. The next step is current, and the space that we're currently in, are people starting to understand how that technology works and making sure you're doing so in a trusted way, making sure that the information that you are sharing in order to get those predictions is something that is trusted, it is safe, it is secure, being able to make sure you're using your data in a way that isn't going to be exposed to others, and that you're only using information that's in the best interest of others without biases, in a way that you want to represent your company and the values in your brand as a school. And so the place that we're doing, what I see is the next big step is being able to take this generative AI technology utilize a large wealth of information and to understand and organize the data that we all have. Every university, Gonzaga included, is sitting on a huge wealth of information. A lot of universities suffer from a data hoarding problem, and that's okay. You know, we don't need to have all of those records from 100 years ago to fuel this, but being able to better harness that generative AI technology to make people's lives a little bit easier, to better serve the students. How can I, as a student, perhaps have my own AI concierge or advisor that can take me through the steps of going to a university? For me, as a first generation graduate student, an undergraduate student, I needed a little bit more help to understand the times when I needed to reach out to an advisor. There were times when I felt a huge amount of imposter syndrome, but I could have felt a little more comfortable, perhaps with guidance, proactive guidance from an automated process or a technology that says, it's okay, here are the things that you, Adam, you, this person can do in order to be successful, and have it learn around my behaviors. That's currently the next step that I think that we're going to take, is this idea of generative AI being incredibly personalized and also safe and secure. So how do we take and make sure that my information and me as a person, I have autonomy and I have security for my information, yet I can be served by these technologies in a way that is vastly beneficial and doesn't take a lot of individual human power on your side as an administrator. You know, not having to actually hire an advisor for each individual student, allow advisors to do their job best, which is be hands-on, one-on-one with a student, having interpersonal communication. So like using this technology to push people a little bit closer to those in-person experiences that are a little bit richer and take off some of that administrative head. Yes.
I can see why you're in a leadership position. I
I get on these rants, right? I get on my soapbox, but it's very, very interesting. It's so fun to get to talk to passionate people about this stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why, I mean, I love doing this podcast. I get to dig deep with some pretty awesome people. Well, I know we're almost out of time here. I want to be respectful of your time. Advice to newly minted Gonzaga grads. What words of wisdom would you give them?
Advice to newly minted Gonzaga grads. I forgot this was one of the questions. You know, I would say advice to newly minted Gonzaga grads. It's always an interesting time, and you might need to take on different roles than you would ever expect it. Say yes to a lot of things. Protect your individual wellness and have a strong understanding of what your capabilities are. But know that you need to bring value to whatever endeavor that you're taking on. And so be willing to get into uncomfortable places, like it, push yourself beyond what you feel comfortable with doing all of the time, while also protecting your wellness. I think it's really, really important for new students entering the job market to say yes to a lot of things that they may feel uncomfortable doing, to learn a lot more about yourself.
That's awesome. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. We'll play pickleball soon.
Yeah.
And I appreciate getting to do this with you.
Yeah, man.
All right.
Cheers.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire. And go Zags.